sunshine, tears and rain, precious memories of years gone by. Hours of darkness, fear and pain, all the time that we had. When all that's left is a photograph, not one golden moment in the sun. Doing what had to be done.
Hello and welcome back to Callum and David's Any Requests podcast. This is, of course, our weekly podcast where you, the listener, can donate £5 a month through our Patreon and get us to do a podcast about absolutely anything you want.
That is entirely correct. Well done, David. Only the third take on the introduction.
Yeah, well, we're all of a flutter because of what we're going to talk to.
I mean, we're both very excited.
We are.
The type of energy, if you were a teacher and you walked into a classroom with this energy...
Settle down!
That's exactly the reaction.
Yeah.
So we'll try our best to settle down whilst also conveying the infectious energy of that is dictated by this incredible podcast request.
Absolutely. So this week we are looking at a request from our dear friend Adam, who's been a huge advocate and listener and supporter of our podcast right the way back from the beginning, Jonathan Creek. And yeah, he's also a good friend of ours, and we are, I guess, to blame for this request, because if I remember rightly, it was us that introduced him to what he's asked for. And this is, depending on if we continue to do it episode by episode, it's a 13-week request. So 11-week, isn't it? Request. But yeah, it is the long forgotten, although thank you John Oliver last week for bringing this up randomly on his show on HBO.
It's almost like we're slightly ahead of the curve.
Absolutely. It is, of course, the wonderful Cop Rock.
Cop Rock.
Now, I became aware of Cop Rock many years ago, possibly even when we still at drama school. Because I found it on a YouTube black hole of looking at ridiculous things.
Makes sense.
And I discovered that there was, in 1990, a gritty police procedural television show that was also a musical made called Cop Rock. And I found a specific song called Let's Be Careful Out There. And I watched the video and I went, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life, bar none. And I showed everyone I knew. And you and I did some work with Adam out in Beijing for 4 months, and we spent a lot of that time drunk. One particular moment of madness, I think we were talking about Cop Rock, and he was asking about it, and I showed him Let's Be Careful Out There, and he immediately found all 11 episodes that exist and promptly binged them and became absolutely obsessed. So sorry, Adam, for doing that to you.
Yeah.
But now he's getting his revenge by making us talk in depth about Cop Rock every month or whatever. So yeah,
what is there to say? There's so much to say.
There is. There's so much to say. It is created bizarrely by Stephen Bochco, who, if you don't know Stephen Bochco, is kind of the pioneer of the American police procedural. He's the guy that created Hill Street Blues, commonly known as the best kind of police show ever made.
My favourite police procedural theme tune of all time.
Absolutely. By Mike Post, who plays a big part in he's music supervisor for this series.
Nice link there.
Yeah, he's the gentleman who plays the keyboards in the opening credits as well. Also NYPD Blue, LA Law. I mean, this guy's like the king of police procedural. And in 1990, he decided to make Cop Rock. And he decided to make it, he says, because a Broadway producer had approached him about a year previous, wanting to make Hill Street Blues, the musical, on stage. And he loved the idea, but they spent a few months, and he just went, we couldn't make it work. It just didn't really make sense. Hill Street Blues was obviously many, many series, lots of different plot lines to kind of condense it down into a 2-hour show and then make music make sense into that. Couldn't do it. But he said he never kind of left the idea of a police procedural musical. And so then eventually came up with the idea for Cop Rock. It was bought by ABC, American Television Channel, in 1990, and it ran for 11 episodes, and then they went, stop this now immediately and never do it ever again. It was critically destroyed. No one watched it. It has since, I think, was voted the 8th worst television series ever made by TV Guide. America. And it's kind of become a cult sort of phenomena that, as I mentioned, John Oliver brought up on his show on HBO last week. It's every now and then kind of thrown out into pop culture. I seem to remember there's a Family Guy gag, I think, about Cop Rock in one of the episodes. So it's kind of this still relatively little known thing. This very weird curiosity of American television. Possibly beaten only by the TV show Heil Honey, I'm Home, which I think is still the weirdest thing that's ever happened in the history of television.
Yeah.
Which, for those of you who don't know, is a sitcom about Hitler and Eva Braun living next door to a Jewish couple, but it's set in the 70s and the Hitler's a New York, Italian American. It's so odd and so offensive, and I don't understand how it happened. But that aside, I think Cop Rock might be the most surreal television show that has ever been created.
Surreal is the word, and it is the word we're going to be using a lot, so get used to us overusing that word. But it is really the perfect word to describe the experience of watching this program. And do you watch the program, or does the program happen to you? I felt like we were complicit in pressing play, but after that, we were just experiencing something.
Yeah.
And to that degree, it has great power. But I feel like, to give you some context of what we're talking about, first of all, just go watch Cop Rock. Mm-hmm. You won't regret it. Or if you will, it'll be for different reasons. But I'm going to give you a little idea just from the opening. So we open with a cold open. We love a cold open, don't we, David and I?
Yep.
So before the credits, we open on a helicopter shot of the city of LA. Looks like real footage, found footage. We then follow two individual cops, and then it pans out to realise we've got actually a big team of cops all riding in a safari, as it were, on their way in unmarked cars to a raid. They eventually approach this house, chain the door to a car, break into the house, and we realise this is a big drugs raid by the looks of things. Kind of SWAT teams, lights, sounds of more cars, backup, helicopter, very dramatic. It reminded me a little bit of, I said to you, Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
Which I don't really know that well, but I know the aesthetic and the feel of it. Mm-hmm. I know it when I see it.
Well, it reminded me very much of Hill Street Blues or NYPD Blue. It's classic kind of, late 80s, early 90s American police procedural, right?
Yeah, it's pretty classic.
Yeah.
Having said that...
But it's gritty.
I was about to say, it's
and
better than...
And that's the important thing, is it's gritty. And that's why, actually, I said to you after we watched the episode, I said, God, it's really made me want to go back and watch The Wire. And I cannot believe I'm sat here comparing Cop Rock to The Wire. But that sort of David Simon gritty realism is very much present in the opening of this first episode.
They go in there, suddenly there's a lot of chaos, so much cross-cutting, improvised dialogue, very realistic reactions to things. They find a woman, they're taking a child away from this woman because they're going to arrest her for being in what we then learn is a crack house. And there's a kind of torn emotion of the police officer played by Kathleen... the mother is played by Kathleen Wilhoite. Mm. Don't really know how to say that word.
Oh, I don't know.
W-I-L-H-O-I-T-E. I think it's probably some kind of French. And there's a lot of kind of real pathos there. And it seems like emotions are running high, the stakes are really high, and it's really gritty, really gritty. And then they're arresting several of the gentlemen, one in particular, who starts to kind of talk back to the police. And then very craftily...
It's very secret.
Seamless. It is secret.
Yeah.
The dialogue just turns into a rap. And it's It's like they tricked me. I was like,
I'm so glad you felt that as well, because I did the same thing. It was about 16 bars into the rap before I realised it was a rap.
There
was a delay.
Yeah.
In my mind of what was happening, I was like, how did they do that? And
absolutely.
Have they been rapping the whole time and I've not been noticing? Like, it's so weirdly subtle. And I'm quite, like, and I was like, if you're doing this with the first number, maybe you should be questioning if this is the right thing to do. If you've gone, oh, we better trick them into not noticing that we're putting music in, maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
That's exactly the first introduction to the music of the show, which is obviously integral to a police procedural musical. But it does feel like they're hiding it, burying it in the dialogue.
Do you remember when we did another one of Adam's requests, The Last Dragon, and the big fight scene at the end where they like didn't show all the people that came from the dojo to help him, and then just one by very secretly
suddenly there were lots of
and
them,
and it was like, it felt like that, it was like that they didn't want us to know that the music was happening.
Why is it Well, I thought maybe it's because they're like, okay, there's going to be some, you know, prejudice towards this. People who don't like musicals aren't going to respect this. So the first introduction of a song has got to be really subtle and really smart. So they did that. And then they launch into the full-blown rap, which is the most typical 90s rap you've ever heard in your life. Although it does have quite a strong political message.
I'm glad you said that. I was going to say, lyrically, it's dreadful. It's incredibly basic. And the rhymes could have been done by an eight-year-old. But the message, and this is something that I think is very interesting, and I was reading an article in Stereogum earlier on, basically saying that actually maybe Cop Rock was really ahead of its time, because it does talk about a lot of things that no other TV show had actually mentioned at that point. And this rap in particular, basically the message of the rap is coming from a couple of kind of African-American gang members that have been arrested in this kind of melee at the beginning, essentially saying to each other, there's no point in trying to reason or plead with them because they're white cops and they're out for us no matter what. And that's kind of the message of the rap. And I was like, in 1990, not a lot of shows were saying that.
Not at all. And there's this kind of line that keeps coming back that eventually ends the song on this. I think it actually might be the title of the song. In these streets, we got the power. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's this real divide. And it reminded me a lot of the research that we did on LA in the 60s, right?
Yeah.
The 50s and 60s, where in order to survive, African-American communities and people of color in general had to really build that divide and felt safer when they were policed by themselves.
Well, it's the Quantum Leap episode.
A prime example of that. And also Aquarius talking a lot about that and the Black Panther movement, you know. And there were real elements to some deeper discussion there. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it's a terrible, terrible rap.
Yeah.
And it does feel very comedic. Yeah. And I don't think that's just us looking back on the past and being mean.
No.
Like, it is quite bad. Particularly because we've recently watched quite a lot of documentaries where you go back and look at 90s rap and you go, it was really good. There's lots of it that's so good. And it just didn't kind of stand up to it. So musically, it's terrible, and that does make it quite comedic. But if you can get past that, like you say, great message.
Yeah, and I mean, also you've got to think as well, contextually, you're talking about 2 years before Rodney King and the LA riots in 92. So tensions are stoking in real time of when this was actually being filmed and made. So it's a very contemporaneous look at what was happening as a microcosm in Los Angeles, especially South Central, places like Compton and Inglewood at that time. There's also songs there.
Yeah. And there's also something worth mentioning here, because after this, we're about to go to the credits. But I want to also just say that the performances at this point, that's that gritty realism, right?
Yes.
The acting is top level. Yeah. I would say better than Hill Street Blues, better than Beverly Hills, you know, Cop and all the other shows that a lot of those actors had worked on. And quite a lot of those actors still work in police procedurals today.
Yeah.
Like they're kind of experts at that kind of thing. There's real weight that I haven't seen in a lot of American dramas in general.
Yeah.
Certainly not from 1990. So I'm thinking, this is amazing. And even through this terrible rap, you're selling it with this amazing pathos. Then, this is all before the theme tune, remember? This is all before the opening credits.
Yeah.
We then go to the opening credits.
Oh, my
lord. And my brain melts.
So, there's so much to talk about these opening credits. Number one, the opening credits and all subsequent songs in this episode are written by Randy Newman. The opening credits also performed by Randy Newman, but as in actually performed on screen by Randy Newman at a piano.
Surrounded by other musicians.
Surrounded by other musicians.
In a studio.
In a studio, but also there are members of the cast in the studio, but out of character. So it's a very odd breaking of the fourth wall at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
It's like they shot the first season and then they said, oh, by the way, Randy's finally got around to doing the theme tune.
Yeah.
Now he's done all the other songs. Before we go to the rap party, you're all invited to the studio in LA where Randy and the band and Mike Post are going to play the song to you.
Yeah.
But also, if you look carefully, it's not just a music studio. It's also, it looks like a music studio in a... So, imagine you were watching a play at the Etc. Theatre in Camden.
Yeah.
For those of you who aren't London-centric or don't know, that's a tiny black box theatre.
Yeah.
It seats about 45, says 50, doesn't, maybe 40 maybe. People in that theatre. Imagine a play that was set in
the
two
tech
spaces.
Box is up a ladder.
It's a great spot. I love
it's great. Yeah,
check it out. But imagine you're watching a play there, and the play had two settings. It was set in a police station and a recording studio.
Yeah.
The designer would do something with that one tiny space to incorporate both studio aspects and a police station aspect.
Yeah.
That's what this is.
Yeah,
that's
where they're in. It's like a police desk.
Yeah.
But it's in a recording studio.
And there are some files on the piano.
On the piano, yeah.
But, which is fine.
Yeah.
If the people from the series, the characters, are in that space, that would make more sense. But it's not. It's the actors out of costume.
Just enjoying watching him perform.
Before they go to the rap party.
Yeah.
So whatever they're doing there, there's a lot going on.
There's so much going on and none of it's working with each other. And also, again, remember we said it's gritty?
Yeah.
But then you've got you've got a friend in me, Randy Newman, doing a song called Under the Gun, which is in no way gritty and is in every way a Randy Newman song sung by Randy Newman.
I mean, I adore Randy Newman. Oh, I find it very difficult to hear a bad word against him. And there are some great songs in this, genuinely. Yeah. Songs where you go, God, that's off a Randy Newman album that I haven't heard before. Where's that? But this song is not, this opening number is not one of them.
No.
It's kind of someone doing a Randy Newman impression.
Yeah.
And then occasionally you hear the words, under the gun.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, are you doing a Bob Dylan voice? Is this Randy Newman doing Bob Dylan after a few too many drinks? Like, this is so unintelligible. I can't hear a single lyric apart from eventually you say the word, under the gun.
Fat man walking all over.
Yeah, that's very good. I like that. It's not Randy's best work. Unfortunately, we're going to hear it 11 more times.
Yeah.
And it's possibly the worst song in the series. But it's very weird. And I love that bit of detail about Mike Post being in, playing the keys.
Also, Mike Post, I should say, the A-Team, Quantum Leap, iconic 80s theme tunes.
Amazing. So you have this opening, and then it follows, picks up where we left off after the cold open. We're now in the courthouse. There's a court case. They're trying to get these people charged because they've arrested them all for being drug addicts and criminals and all the rest of
it. The woman's worried about losing her baby.
That's picked up on. It's really nicely kind of played. There's a relationship there between the female police officer, who's very good and ambitious, but also relating to the people that she's working with, surrounded by a very male-dominated world. There's lots of sexist language, very kind of realistic, gritty drama.
Yeah.
So we get into the court, and then eventually this court judge says, I'm sorry, I can't put any of them in jail because there's no room in the prisons, and you haven't collected evidence well enough because it's shoddy police work. So, no, we're going to have to let them go.
Yeah.
And everyone's kind of, pretty annoyed about that. and everyone leaves the... And then I completely forgot it was a musical.
Because
it just went back to being a drama.
There's not a song for a while. But the next one we come to is a good one. But then there's a kind of another big raid that kind of takes place.
They go out. They're following a van, and they end up in a pursuit car chase with this van.
Yeah.
And eventually, a lot of cops come together and stop it because you know, using the cars to block the roads off. There's a park, so they're all saying, "Don't shoot, don't shoot," because the, you know, certain cops are a bit trigger happy. But there's also a gunman on the loose. He turns around, the gunman jumps out of the car, and he takes an Uzi, or semi-automatic machine gun, and kills, shoots two policemen and kills one.
Yeah,
kills one of them.
Yeah,
and then this, the most out of all this good acting, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
we talked about the good, and I'm going to come back to lots of good acting because there's lots more to talk about there. This is not one of those times.
No, which is weird because it's Ernie Hudson, who's genuinely a good actor and the only person I actually recognised in this whole episode. he's the fourth Ghostbuster, and he's specifically an amazing performance of his as a reformed heroin addict in The Basketball Diaries, and he helps DiCaprio get clean in that film. It's a phenomenal performance by him. It was genuinely and the most recognisable actor in this episode, as I say, and that's what I was like, what? Why are you the one that's letting the team down here? Because it is the most melodramatic
His reaction. Partner's been shot and killed, right? And he runs out after also being shot in the leg, I think, or something.
Yeah.
Or is he? Or is he? No, he's just crouching down.
He plays like he's been killed, that he's dying, that he's got a wound in his stomach and he's clutching it.
Yeah.
But then he moves his hand out and there's nothing there. So he's always just got a stitch, I think.
He's playing that.
I'm not quite sure what's happened to him.
His anxiety.
He's fine physically.
I don't know what that is, but he was playing that he's been shot in the abdomen and can't move his legs and then drags himself out of the car.
Yeah, but he's
and then immediately sees his partner on the floor, gets up, runs over to him and starts beating on his chest going, "Don't you die on me, man!"
Yeah, and then screams into the sky.
Yeah, it's like he's just seen Willem Dafoe in Platoon.
Yeah, he's like,
he's doing a piss take of Willem Dafoe in Platoon.
Yeah, yeah.
"Don't you die on me, man! You aren't there, man!"
That's exactly what it is.
Terrible, terrible acting. And then, as a result of all that, we have everyone kind of leaving the police station, extremely upset and angry. They're annoyed that they didn't get arrested. They realise that the guy who'd shot and killed the cop was the one who the day before had been released by the judge because there wasn't room in the prison. And everyone's very angry and upset, and so they all kind of go out for a beer to let off some steam, and then our kind of main hero police woman, who's had the relationship with the drug addict, she drives home, after a bit of a weird bombshell, where her police partner, who drops her off, says, "I'm going to be thinking about you all night." And he's made a couple of like sexist comments to her that she's brushed off. And then she turns around to him and says, "I'll be thinking about you too." It's like, what?
Yeah.
You're into him.
But again, just before that line exchange, they have this really lovely, quite like realistic moment of like kind of a lot of subtext where they're just sat and he says, you know, "We can't just keep sitting here in this car not talking about anything. We both know what's going on with these feelings that we have." And it's really lovely.
It is nice. I just, that whole scene, I didn't expect.
No.
To be the dynamic. But it made me interested. It wasn't necessarily a bad thing. I was really surprised. Turns out, you know, because we know that she's married, she mentions her husband. And she goes into her house to her husband.
Yeah. And I think he's a forensic.
Yes.
He seems to be the forensic guy.
Yeah. Internal affairs, head of forensic, or the guy on the scene, certainly comes later as forensic. And he's up working on some papers. He's significantly older than her.
Yeah.
A bit larger.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the most kind of dashing, young man that she might be into. Although neither is the police partner she's meant to be secretly in love with.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know what's going on there. But she says, oh, you know, you didn't come for drinks. He said, no, I've had some work to do. And she's like, oh, you coming to bed?
He's sat at his desk late at night working away.
And she says, you coming to bed? He said, I'm going to stay up and do a bit more work.
Yeah.
She says, well, I'll probably be asleep by the time you come up. Mm-hmm. She doesn't say it like that, but we know what she's saying, which is that means another night of us not sharing a bed together, kind of thing, or being romantic together, or getting up to any naughty stuff.
Yeah,
you know what I'm suggesting, listeners. And he does this amazing look, and I mean this genuinely, where she just kind of cradles him and says night night, and he looks down, as if to say, I so wish I could be the man that you want me to be. Like, he says so much in just a look.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that scene, because of that look, is just transformed. This is really high, cool film level drama. It's like brilliant acting.
But luckily, you don't get to enjoy that feeling very much, because little piano creeps in.
Little piano man.
And we go, oh no. Oh, it's coming. And then we have a beautiful ballad sung by this man. He remains sat down and near motionless the entire 4-minute song.
Yeah.
Like, okay, no, not gonna stand up at any point, not gonna do anything.
It becomes a song about how you didn't know he was paralyzed.
Yes.
And that's why he because the song is a really genuinely beautiful song called She Chose Me.
Yeah.
I'd never heard before. I've listened to a lot of Randy Newman tunes, and I adore the way he puts songs together. It's quite unique and original and quirky and just quite socialist, and there are loads of wonderful things about Randy Newman songs, and this is one that I was like, this maybe it is on an album somewhere that I just haven't heard.
No, I'm pretty sure he wrote all of them bespoke for the show.
I'm pretty sure he did as well, but
I've read,
I can't imagine this song not being something he'd sing at a concert or something, but I haven't seen it, and I've watched a lot of stuff, so I think it might be one of his best songs ever. Very simple song about and probably a bit autobiographical, knowing Randy Newman when he talks about himself as being a describes himself as a froggish man.
Yeah.
And he kind of, you know, plays into this character who says, you know, I know what I look like, you know, I know that I'm not the most handsome or youngest guy in the world, and but this beautiful woman at the end of the day, she chose me, and that's incredible. With this underlying subtext of I wish I could be the man she wants me to be, with this now added underlying subtext, which is purely from the staging, which is that he's lost the use of both his legs. because he does not move, as you say, quite rightly, he doesn't move a muscle from the whole thing. But there's some kind of, which I feel would be powerful if it was a stage musical and you had loads of dance numbers and then you had one where someone just sat in a chair.
And
I'd be like, oh, I get that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, this is a TV show and it's a tight shot on his, like mid shot on his face, head and shoulders. So it doesn't have any powerful effect.
No.
But the song is sung and acted beautifully, and it's a great lyrical song. And if you don't want to watch Cop Rock, do Google this song, She Chose Me, because it would be a great rep song for someone to... I might put it in my rep.
I was thinking that. I was like, got any actors out there who want a really interesting rep song that no one will have heard before?
Sing that an audition.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they'd say, oh, that's really lovely.
Where's that from? You'd go, oh, it's from the pilot episode of the TV show Cop Rock. And they'd go, what's that? And you'd have to explain it. And they'll go, well, it was... We really enjoyed meeting you. We're seeing a lot of people.
Enjoy your therapy.
That'd
be the end of that. But if you can get past that. So it's a beautiful song, but really kind of weirdly placed. Then we go to the policeman chief.
Yes.
I believe, who's in the office.
Yep.
He's interrupted by he's woken up by his like assistant, his number two.
Yep.
And he's for some reason on the sofa asleep. He's not gone home.
No, yeah.
And I get the impression he might be like hungover or something.
Yeah.
And he pulls a gun. It's like a comedy bit where he gets woken up, and so he pulls the gun on his assistant, and they're fine with it. And I'm like, it's just a weird bit of slapstick.
So something
changed it, didn't it?
I reading up on it, I think Vochko was genuinely wanting it to be a bit of a black comedy. Like, I think
right.
I think, I mean, obvious, like, you can't be as an intelligent writer as he clearly is and not know that some of those songs are comedic.
Yeah.
In how you're using them and where they come. So I think there's definitely a tongue-in-cheek element of the show. I don't think he thought he was making a gritty, realistic musical, I think.
But that is what he made, and that's what's weird.
It is what he made! But like, as in, like, I think he was trying to experiment, I think, and see if could he make something that was gritty realism sometimes, and then sometimes
surreal comedic black comedy
musical. Turned out he couldn't, but he gave it a very good go.
We know that now, and he did bravely, and now we have Cop Rock. So, exactly. You know, no criticism there, and it's better. The world's better for having this in it. Yeah, but there's this weird kind of, yeah, a bit of a very obvious comedy. Then he has a shootout with a robot cowboy, which he keeps in his cupboard.
Yeah,
and I'm like, okay,
that's a weird
can
bit,
we go
yeah.
back to when we opened with a helicopter shot in LA? And everyone was talking over each other and about a drugs trade. And then you talked about racial differences and disparity in LA in 2 years before Rodney King's, you know, how is that and this together? Yeah. But there
we
are.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, I've got your speech. He's written this guy's got to make a speech about the death of the cop.
Yeah.
He's been killed by the guy who should have been arrested, et cetera, et cetera. And anyway, he then goes and has this weird speech about how he loves guns. And then he goes and gives the speech. And it's a really good speech that he hasn't written.
And I want to pick up on this because the speech had been written by the partner of the dead cop.
Yeah, I think it has.
Yeah, it is. It's Ernie Hudson. And I was like, oh, because I was expecting that to be like, oh, he's this speech is too personal because he's too close to what, and it's like too aggressive towards the people that can, and that's going to turn into something of like, how could he write that speech with everything he's gone through? Because there is actually a scene previous to this scene where he goes and visits him and says, oh, you know, you've got to take time off. And then he goes and writes a speech.
Right.
And I was like, oh, but then no, the speech is it's a fine speech
made to be like it's come from the chief himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I didn't realize was his duties.
I don't know why it needed to be him that wrote the speech. But yeah.
Anyway, the speech goes very well. We hear the end of it. Everyone claps, and he says at the end of it, "I'm calling on the mayor to make room in the prisons because of this," which I really get, right? Because this conversation has been happening in America since the invention of, well, basically slavery and prisons in general. Yeah. And anyone who's interested in that, watch 13. It's 13th, is it?
Yeah, or even better, listen to our podcast on legalizing cannabis.
Actually, that will tell you an awful lot about the prison system, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good point.
It's not better. It's not better.
I was going
to
say,
just to clarify, that was me being funny. I don't genuinely believe that we're
in the introduction. You said Adam was a really good advocate for podcast to become in general, and I was like, why is he needing to advocate for us? Are we being cancelled?
Yeah.
Like, that's not going to happen.
Well,
I'm like,
if it's
maybe
not,
it is because we're claiming to be better than award-winning documentaries. On the history of the prison system and racial disparity in America. But there you are. It is a really interesting subject. And I thought, God, they're tackling this political hot potato where some people believe that the answer to cleaning up all the problems that LA is experiencing at this time and America in general, at large, can be solved by building more prisons. That is also one of the things that results in huge disproportionate amounts of people of color and black people, black men specifically, being thrown into prison for tiny misdemeanors.
Yeah.
Because that's become a privatized business in itself.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this could be really interesting. Mm-hmm. I wonder what this is going to happen here. And then
what's going to happen, don't you?
The mayor came.
Yeah.
And she is an amazing actor with the most incredible hair.
Didn't listen to anything she said because I was just staring at her hair for so long.
It's the biggest hair.
Yeah.
It kind of looked like, you know, when you see Dolly Parton, you go, that's the biggest hair I've ever seen, but it's not real. It's made from, like, candy floss.
Yeah.
This is the biggest real hair I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's just on the right side of believable.
87 cans of hairspray have been used on that.
Incredible. And really weird. I don't know why.
No.
But it's just a very weird design and hairstyle. Hey, 90s were a weird time. In fact, actually, this was made a month after I was released, a month after I was born. Mm. So maybe a lot of weird things were happening around that time.
That's, yeah.
So then she says, you're absolutely right, and we're going to build a prison right here on this site, and it's going to be ready and opening to receive prisoners in 12 months. I'm like, okay, that's to pedal it back. 12 months to build a work, and that's not going to happen when you haven't got the funding because the federal government don't want to give it to you.
Yeah. But also, she said she delivers this, and then because she finishes off the speech as well by saying, right, and no one can stop with that, and no one's
going to... Those who want to stop me, try.
Yeah. I was like, why are you being combative? He's just said it's what needs to happen. Like, this is a positive thing, but you've delivered it as if you're a villain and you're saying, I know no one wants me to build more prisons. No one's asking for more prisons, but you know what? I'm going to do it anyway and screw all of you. That was the energy. And I was like, no, but you're... He's just asked for that and you're saying you're going to do it. Why are you being combative?
If it was like a televised... I assume it was probably going to be like a televised speech or something. And if she was saying it to the camera and addressing, like, the powers that be who have tied her hands financially, then maybe, but it wasn't shot like that.
No.
It was just shot like we were in the press corps.
Yeah.
And so we and everyone else was a bunch of neutral journalists.
It was also a weird... Like,
being attacked by two people saying the same thing.
It was like a weird corner of a park as well. Obviously, it's the grounds they're going to build this new prison on.
Yeah.
But because of that, it was just a really weird place to have what was meant to be quite an important press conference for the city.
Yeah, it was like, bizarre.
Four Seasons Total Landscaping.
Yeah, Giuliani had booked that one. So anyway, we go, okay, well, we've got this mayor with big hair. Naturally, we're going to follow her into the next scene.
Yep, and we do. And the scene starts on a close-up of what is meant to be a portrait of her.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's almost cubist, actually.
It's not meant to be, though.
No, it's not meant to be.
If you're listening at home...
It's not meant to be.
It's... I would say, you know those portraits of dogs playing cards?
Yeah.
Well, like, the real ones of, like, the ones that... And I think it's like acrylic paint where it's, like, you can see
quite
the brush
thick.
Strokes
yeah.
and they're thick.
Yeah.
It's like that, and then someone's gone, oh, we're going to paint over this... to reuse the canvas of a portrait of a lovely lady, but they've left some of the original painting in, and it's got it's really weird. It's a really weird doctored painting.
Yeah, and it doesn't look anything remotely like her. It's her hair. They've got the hair right.
It's because that's the bit they painted on.
Yeah,
is the hair.
But it's not her face.
It's an old woman from, like, I don't know. It's like a portrait of James Madison's wife, someone from like hundreds of years before. And already in their 70s. Like, quite an old lady, but an old lady from history.
Yeah.
Who's not got the same face as this person.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
with the hair of the mayor.
Yeah.
Got the mayor's hair.
Mayor's hair.
Got mayor. Mayor.
Mayor.
Mayor.
Mayor.
So that happens.
Yeah.
And that is enough to occupy you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, rudely interrupted with my fascination with the painting.
Yeah, is the... interrupted by the bass line from The Joker by the Steve Miller Band.
Quite specifically.
That's what it is. It's the only thing it can be, because it's what it is. And we kind of just went, sorry, Steve Miller Band? I was like, yeah, because it can't be anything else. Turns out it wasn't. Turns out it was apparently an original Randy Newman song. But, I mean, he's nicked the bass line.
When you say original, it's the least original thing Randy Newman's ever written. And, I mean... Again, no bad words said about Randy Newman's body of work, but this is not his finest hour.
I think It's Gonna Rain Today is one of the most beautiful songs ever written.
Oh gosh, yeah, absolutely phenomenal. And actually, You've Got a Friend of Me's a beautiful number when you listen to it on its own without necessarily the cartoons. Well, there's some people like that, they don't know.
The cartoons.
Yeah, the cartoon, the Toy Story.
The cartoons.
The animation, the Pixar.
Isn't it one
animation?
Of the most critically acclaimed films ever?
I don't want to disparage it. I like Toy Story. I like it a lot. I'm feeling quite old today.
Mm.
I was working with some young people today, and I actually non-ironically said the YouTube, and I just watched. Six teenagers just start pissing themselves laughing. I was like, oh, it's happened, isn't it? I've become what I hate. Anyway, it's a terrible song with the bass line, the Steve Miller Band, Joker.
Probably my favourite Miller Band brother.
I mean, he's the Labour leader we never had,
yeah,
right?
He is, yeah.
Steve Miller Band. And he... Anyway, we have the kind of beginnings of a bridge. Now, the bridge is a bit in a song that connects normally two other sections, like a verse to a chorus. Mm-hmm. Or a chorus to a mid-late sometimes.
Yeah.
It's the connecting bit. You hear rappers go, take it to the bridge sometimes, don't you? That was a famous song. What did that happen in? That T-Pain someone? Oh, no. It was a guy who collaborated with Justin Timberlake. Take it to the chorus. Take it to the bridge.
Oh, okay. I thought you were thinking about an album track of Limp Bizkit's Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavoured Water.
Do they say take it to
the bridge? Take it to the Matthews Bridge.
Oh, nice. I like that. Geographical reference and musical reference. Mm. I don't know why people do that all the time. Musicians tell us in recorded tracks how the structure of the song is going to work.
Yeah.
It's just messages to the engineer, isn't it?
Yeah.
But anyway,
Messages to the Engineer was a great album by Suzanne Vega.
To be honest, that absolutely should have been.
That's great.
Save that for one of our next musical podcasts.
Yeah.
So anyway, this dude who we've never met before seems to be in love with the mayor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think he's one of her lackeys, assistants, but he looks like fat 80s daddy works in a garage.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of, but he's in a suit.
Yeah.
And he's in love with her. And he says, very much repeating this kind of phrase, you're the one. Mm-hmm. You're the one. And it's like a short 4-bar segment that's just on repeat, which is the bridge. But the song starts with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
it goes directly to a middle eight that she sings.
It goes directly to a middle eight that she sings, and the backing vocals from Whitesnake come in.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, we've gone from the Steve Miller Band to an 80s hair metal track.
Yeah.
And there are about 1,000 of them.
Yeah.
And then she sings all about her life and upbringing.
Yeah.
And that she went to school and she got her education.
Yeah.
And then to reveal what her education was, she opened a metal briefcase and inside it was about, I don't know, $200.
Yeah.
Not a lot. Like 3 short stacks of money, all glowing in neon green light, with light coming out of the briefcase.
Because they're bribing her. That was the bribe from the briefcase.
She said, I got my education, and then she opened that.
I think she's like saying, I'm smart, so I'm going to take this money.
Right.
Is the thing.
Is that in order to not build?
Yeah, I believe so.
Right. Oh, I just didn't get that.
Okay.
I probably wasn't concentrating. But you forgive me, there was a lot going on.
There was a lot going on. There's a lot going on. There's the painting, there's the hair. Steve Miller Band was there.
I don't know, yeah.
There's so much going on.
So anyway, he sings this song all about you're the one, and he's kind of being sexy to her. And she sings about her upbringing in life.
No, but again,
takes a bribe.
The main point of the song is about the bribe.
Yeah, but
how the local government is corrupt. That's the point of the song.
That's
most of what the song's about.
But I didn't come across very well. It came across that I somehow had to invest in the history of this woman's life. Like she'd had a rags to riches journey story. Except the lyrics didn't tell you that, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was more like a middle class to riches journey. And they were bribing her with not a lot of money.
No.
It just was...
It was magic.
It had the glow.
It did have the glow.
We know all about the glow.
Mm-hmm.
Another podcast request. Now, that's where I've got to. That's the end. That's run out of steam now. So we're end of that song. Oh, yes. And now... We then go to another court case, which we don't know anything about. We've had no context on this at all.
No.
Save one of the witnesses is a cop we've met before. He's a bit gung-ho.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got his arm in a sling.
Yeah.
There's a weird... Oh, my goodness gracious.
What?
We have completely forgotten an entire scene where there's an interrogation... where a young black guy is being tortured by the police.
Oh my God, you're absolutely right, sorry.
Because they're stopping him from going to the toilet.
Okay. And that's there's a whole scene of absolute raging police brutality where the guy who was in the van with the cop killer, the guy who shot the cop, he's brought in for questioning because he gives himself up willingly.
Yeah.
And he says, I need to go to the bathroom. And they make him drink. It's really weird.
So it's a weird form of torture. And he's getting more and more upset, as you would we've all been there when we really need a wee.
Every time you walk into a theatre.
Yeah. I'm particularly bad at that.
I mean, I have that paranoia though, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to be in the middle of a row anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, that hasn't happened for a long time because being close to other people is illegal.
Yeah,
but,
that's true.
You know, one day it won't be. And then we'll all have to revert to the adult nappies.
Wee again. Yeah.
So anyway, no adult nappies for this man. He's desperate that he's going to wee himself.
Yeah.
And keep saying, please, I can't drink anymore. You'll drink it. And then he's like, where's my lawyer? And he's like, oh, that you don't understand. You're not even going to be used as a witness because everything we're doing to you is against your constitutional rights.
Yes!
Like, I don't know if you would say that to him.
No, I don't think you would.
I think that's for us, isn't it?
Yeah.
As viewers. And then he's like, I promise you, I don't know any, don't know him. If I speak in here, I'm as good as dead. So you may as well either kill me in here. And then they kind of say, well, if you don't tell us, then there are loads of other guys outside this door who want to beat you up.
Yeah.
They want a one-to-one with you. So you better tell us. And then he does wee himself, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then they say, oh, this is worse than the crystal meth addict from the other day. I'm like, yeah. I don't think there's time for a joke here.
No. There is something... I can't believe I'm going to compare Cop Rock to The Wire again.
Doing it once is weird enough.
But in the same way that the Wire is so brilliant because it doesn't glorify the police in any way, and it is a very neutral look at the world of crime and law enforcement. This episode Botchko paints the police in a terrible light.
Yeah.
Like, they all come across really badly. And it feels like that's deliberate. And I'm like, that's quite a brave thing to do in 1990, showing the problems within the LAPD.
Being corrupt and full of people who actually are more interested in the arrest, as, to quote the episode, more interested in the chase than they are putting a case together.
Yeah.
Which someone says in a bathroom, whilst also talking about problems of cystitis.
Like, yeah.
Maybe urinary infections are and the general problems of having to pee are on Steve Botcher and William M. Finkelstein's mind.
That's what made me think of the scene that we'd forgotten, because
mm.
we're jumping back linearly to where we just left off before the diversion into the earlier scene we'd forgotten, was because our friend in the sling, who's a witness, says... I've got to go make a wee-wee.
Yeah, he does.
And I went, why do so many people need to have a wee in this
episode?
We spend
quite a lot of the time in or outside the bathrooms or talking about urine.
You quite rightly mentioned about why men don't wee in that particular way that is shown in.
So I don't know if you remember this. This is obviously made in 1990. I remember when I started remembering things, probably about 3 or 4 when I got my memory.
Yeah.
I remember men in public bathrooms often used to place their hand
on the wall.
On the wall to support them.
Yeah.
I don't know why. To support them while they were having a wee.
I'm not quite sure.
And then one day it just stopped.
You're right.
No, I don't know when it stopped.
No, but no one does it.
I've never been the type of person to lean on a wall. No. I get it if you're drunk.
Yeah.
And you're trying to... Maybe there's logic there, but this is the middle of the day and this guy's not playing drunk.
And it's in a courthouse.
And it's in a courthouse or the police station. It is a courthouse.
It's a courthouse.
It's a courthouse.
Yeah, it's just before he's called to the staff.
He's just... Yeah. And he's got his own towel with him, that other dude. No way he's got his own towel for wee-wees.
Yeah.
But he does. Yeah. Anyway, write in, let us know. When was the last time you saw a gentleman in a urinal place his hand up on the wall to support him whilst dropping trowel and emptying the old bladder?
Or if you've ever done it yourself, or continue to.
Yeah, obviously you don't have to. There's no pressure to reveal this.
There's a bit of pressure.
We'd like you to, but we're not going to come. We don't know who you are. So
well, know some of you are.
Actually, we know probably quite a lot of you.
Most of you.
It's not a big audience. let us know if that's something that you've seen recently. When did men stop putting their hands on walls whilst urinating? So we're back at the courthouse. We've got this gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
LaRusso, Vincent LaRusso.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And he ends up kind of getting very ratty with the defense lawyer.
Yeah.
Who is saying we should release this man. Now, this is not the same guy that we're beating up in the police brutality scene.
No.
It's not linked to any of the other raids, I don't think.
No. But through this scene, we get the context that the man on trial is a pretty big, pretty high up in the drug world, organized crime world of LA, and he's white. And then there was quite a nice moment where LaRusso says about the fact that what you it's actually a really lovely line where he says, "You all think you live in Los Angeles, you don't. We're in Vietnam."
Yeah.
And he says, "And it's people like him that are responsible for the deaths of cops and the deaths of these young men." And I was like, "That's a really nice touch."
Acknowledgement
and the fact that they made him white as well was a really nice acknowledgement of kind of, yeah, rich white men profiting off the blood of young poor black kids.
The power structures within the criminal underclass, and how that's a result of classism and racism and oppression all coming together. Right?
And again, this is in 1990, and I thought, you know what? Yeah, it is kind of ahead of its time.
But then the judge says, "Well, jury, what do you think? You've heard this speech from Vincent LaRusso, Detective LaRusso, who told you all of this stuff. And that he's a bad guy and that you want to go to jail. What decision have you made?" I'm assuming some time passed, but I didn't catch it.
No.
It was instant.
Yeah, no, I think it briefly... I tell you what happened. It briefly went back to the woman with the baby.
Yes.
In the precinct.
Asking for $50.
Asking for $50. And
in exchange for information.
Yeah, and actually, again, a really lovely moment where she kind of says, a lot of home truths about how addicts are treated and people that are living on the streets.
I can get you into a program. She says, "Well, like, if I go to a program, then I lose my daughter, and my daughter goes into a pretty shoddy care foster system. I don't want that to happen to her, but I don't think I can get clean entirely on my own." Mm-hmm. "Well, what would you do if you're in my situation? You just got to survive, right?"
Yeah.
And she says, "I'm sorry." And she says, "I love how everyone's sorry, but you'll walk past me later on and I'll be in the street tonight and you'll be sorry."
It's a great bit in Rent where they're asking the homeless person if they can be in the documentary. "Hey, artists, got a dollar? Didn't think so." And it's like, just don't sometimes, like... And that's still a debate that goes on today about, and actually it was a great article that you shared, I think maybe your sister sent to you and then you shared it out, about why you always should give money to homeless people,
like regardless of what they're gonna spend it on. I think that was, you're right, it was my sister. So we have this kind of scene, and it's undercut by this judgment that comes from the bailiff of the jury, who's been nominated to obviously give the verdict, and he says, in a very... I can't sing it to you, because it's in the style very specifically sung by a black African-American actor, and it's sung in the style of, like, it starts off like a Negro spiritual, and then it grows into a Baptist...
Gospel,
Billy Preston, Ray Charles style hoot nanny.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why? I don't think I'd ever use that word outside of Jules Holland. But I don't know why, but that's how they give the verdict. Yeah. And it's, he's guilty, judge. He's guilty.
Guilty, yeah. And at this point, I'd like to tell you that the judge is played by Carl Anderson, who is most famous as playing Judas Iscariot in the 1970s film adaptation of Jesus Christ Superstar.
One of the hardest things in the history of musical theatre, one of the biggest roles you can play. Legend.
Yeah.
And a good, bit of a coup to get him on Cops of the Week, right?
Yeah.
So that's pretty good. And it's a really kind of really well sung, put together number. But just, I think, misjudged really badly.
Yeah.
It's in, almost in poor taste. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not bad. Like, it's not morally bad. It's just, oh, why have you done this?
Yeah.
But hey, all the jury turn into a gospel choir and they all start singing and they have robes on and lights happen. Yeah. And then they all take great joy in putting this criminal away, including his defense lawyer.
Yeah,
the interesting part of this song.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's genuinely trying to, you know, get him off because that's his job.
Yeah. So there are a little line injections from the defense team and the accused interject between he's guilty, judge, he's guilty. I was abused as a child is one of the ones that he comes out with, which is a weird line to sing.
Abused as a child, I fed him with a bad crowd.
It
wasn't my fault.
Yeah.
And anyway, the court become manic and really celebrate putting this person in jail, and it's time for him to be put away, and then the song ends.
I'd also like to mention the fact that LaRusso does not participate in this, and it just keeps showing him sat down.
Yeah.
Completely as if it's not happening. And I was like, what's the thought process behind that? Are you thinking, oh, it wouldn't fit his character to be up singing?
Like, he wouldn't fit anyone's
character. Do you know what you're making? Yeah. You've forgotten.
You've gotten the start of the medium that you're trying to, your specific medium that you've chosen doesn't fit
really
this character,
weird,
then you probably...
A weird decision, because it's been him that's the driving force of this verdict. But now it looks like he's not happy about it because he's not joining in the singing. It's very odd.
Oh, then we have kind of follow Russo, knowing that he's celebrated, respected, you know, handy in court, getting people off because he's powerful.
Yeah, we take a turn here, guys. We take a really dark turn.
Yeah, we go and follow.
Wasn't expecting it.
Russo, who's responding to a house call from two other police officers who are under his apprenticeship almost.
Yeah,
you know, he's supervising them.
Yeah.
And they say, hey, we found the guy who was the cop killer.
Yeah.
We found him.
The
here
Uzi
he is.
Guy.
The Uzi
the
guy.
Van. Yeah.
And Russo walks in and the two of them are there, including another cop who's also at Russo's level. Right?
Yeah.
And the...
They found the gun.
They found the gun in the toilet. They've handcuffed him to a chair.
Yeah.
And they say, great, what are you going to do? And he walks in, and the guy, he has been handcuffed at the chair, the suspect says, oh, they've really screwed this one up, Russo. No search warrant, no rights, you know, Miranda rights. Not, they've done nothing by the book, which means that it's very, very difficult to actually put a case together.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's got, no warrant for that. So unlawful entry. They've got their fingerprints all over the murder weapon.
Over the murder weapon, they've contaminated everything.
And it's LaRusso that's telling the two cops that they've done all this badly.
Yeah.
And he's very angry with them.
He says he knows the law better than you do.
Yeah. And so to prove to them how badly they've behaved. Orders them to go sit in the car. He then goes back in and murders the guy.
Straight up shoots him. In front of the other senior cop.
With the Uzi.
Horrendous.
Multiple times.
It's just gross.
Yeah.
And, he's unlawfully murdered. And then the other guy, he says to the other guy, you weren't here. He says, oh, but I was.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, that means he might come in handy later.
Yeah.
And then we have this kind of big procedure where all the top cops come down, congratulate Russo for killing him. And he says, oh, well, he was going for his gun, so I had to.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they're like, oh, aren't you great? And the press are there. Except our, not police chief, but like second, like the one who's actually running the station.
Yeah.
I don't know what his title is. Captain would be his title. He turns up.
Yeah.
And he goes straight up to the murder scene. And he knows straight away something's off.
Yeah.
And who does he talk to?
He talks to the forensician.
The forensic man. The forensicist. Who we heard sing She Chose Me earlier, which is lovely to see him again.
And but I'm not sure what he's doing. He's picking up bits of nothing and putting them into a vial, but I don't know what that, I don't know what it is.
Collecting evidence. And he's got little white rubber gloves on.
But again, because it's amused, there's so many elements of things that you do in a stage production
and
that don't work. It's like, you just, a little, what we call in the industry, bits of business.
Yeah.
I'll do a bit of business. And you don't really have to think too much about it because the audience are generally in a proscenium arch theatre quite a distance away. They don't really need to see what you're doing. It's just keeping your hands busy so you're doing something. Can't really do that when the camera's right there, and that's what he's not doing anything specific.
Yep.
He's just milling around the murder scene, picking up things and putting it in little vials. And I'm like, what are you doing?
Do you want to write that down? Do you want to put a label on it? Yeah.
But he says to our forensician, the captain, are those cuff marks on his hand? He went, oh yeah, they're old though. And he said, they don't look old. And he goes, yeah, they're at least 3 days old. And you're like, oh, he's clearly covering for him. But also he's covering for the man that is about to have an affair with your wife, I think. So that's going to be interesting.
Pretty dodge.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting kind of power dynamic set up there. And the captain then goes up to Russo and says, everyone else might think you're a hero and they'll either buy your kind of BS or they'll cover for you, but I won't. And he's like, what, you think you can catch me kind of thing?
Yeah, well, yeah, he says, oh, you think that. What do internal affairs say? Because that's really the only thing that cops really need to worry about is whether internal affairs are going to... And he says, well, it doesn't matter what they think. I think that you've killed him.
And I'm going to prove it.
Yeah.
So big storylines being set up at the end of this masterfully by Botcher.
Yeah.
And William M. Finkelstein, who co-wrote the episode. Yeah. Give him a bit of credit there.
Absolutely. And they have created a world with lots of different things going on. Much like The Wire. You've got... You've got government corruption at the level of the mayor.
Yeah.
You've got divisions internally within the police force, police corruption at a lower level. You've got the relationship and the kind of systemic racism in the police force and the young black gangs. You've got white kind of drug lords.
Who were taking advantage of all of these people.
Taking advantage of the people. Like, there's so much going on.
They've got a love story, but a burning, you know, the fading of one love story and perhaps the ignition of affair.
Yeah.
It's very complex.
It's very
and masterfully
complex.
Done in
do you
a
know
short
what?
Space of time.
Didn't need any songs.
Don't know why they had to do.
Didn't need any songs.
Weird.
It's a great, gritty police drama.
And you know, I feel like we're allowed to talk about this because, you know, Adam, you'll be listening to this, and we went to work in Beijing, not just with Adam, but also because of Adam. He was the reason we got brought out there.
Absolutely.
And one of the things we used to do in shows that Adam worked on either as choreographer or as kind of assistant directed as well, and taught, put together, musically directed in some cases. So he'll know very well that one thing we do with those particular musicals for children is they want a range of different Western style musical theatre songs. So we'll do like a Lionel Bart style Cockney Knees Up.
Yeah.
We'll do a Disney kind of Disney-esque song, a High School Musical-esque song.
Yeah, a jazzy kick line number.
Jazzy kick line, a little rock and roll song.
Yeah.
There's a genre for everyone in those 10 or 12 numbers. I feel like that's what Randy Newman did with this 100%, one episode.
100%.
Like, just pick a lane.
Yeah, 100%.
It's not musical theatre.
No.
It's not pop music. It's not Randy Newman.
No.
It's bits of Steve Miller and Whitesnake in one of the songs.
Yeah.
Then it's a beautiful ballad. Then it's just
gospel.
And it's a rap.
Yeah, it's a rap.
But I feel like that, you know, I don't say this with a huge amount of criticism because we've done it, but also at the same time... But that fit our brief. I don't think this could have been your brief for this.
No. But, ladies and gentlemen, we've not finished the episode yet.
We've got one more song.
We've got one more number for you.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It's a really... I think it's a very sophisticated musical theatre storytelling song.
So, remember the woman with the baby?
Yeah.
That is a homeless addict. She's on a park bench. And she sings a song about the Sandman to her, not the 90s ECW wrestler, to
Sandman's coming soon,
baby.
And it's lovely. She's kind of, you know, lullabying her. It's a lullaby. She's you know, lullabying her baby to sleep. Can you say lullabying?
Yeah, you just did.
Okay. And it's really sweet. And there's sadness in her eyes. And obviously she's, you know, going through a lot of stuff. And then towards the very end of the song. It's quite a short song. It just says exactly what it needs to about the relationship between a mother and a baby.
Yeah.
And then a man turns up.
Yep.
And says, hey, 200, right?
Yep.
And she goes, yeah. And then he gives her $200 cash.
And takes her baby.
Takes her baby.
She sold her baby for $200.
And he says, don't worry, going to a really nice family. They even gave me a car seat to pick her up in. And then he drives off in a black Volvo, which looks like a hearse.
It does.
Which, I mean, it's not a hearse. It's a black Volvo. My year two teacher had that Volvo. Swore by its reliability.
My dad's had Volvos for years before his current one. He had a big one of those big Volvo estates. The old ones were red.
Yeah.
Very, very reliable.
Good cars.
Yeah.
Good cars. But this one does look like a hearse. Very black, kind of.
Very safe. Because they have they have like a metal cage in between the metal of the body.
Oh.
So they're like the safest car you can buy, pretty much.
That's clever.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why they chose that car, to show the responsibility of the family of the car? Or maybe that was his car, though, not the family's car. Anyway, it depends. But he drives off in this black Volvo, and it's very sad. It's very, very sad.
He's because quite this a recognisable actor. I can't place him, but I've seen him somewhere. In things. Yeah,
it's a beautiful song, sung by the actor. What's her name again? Catherine Hoyhart. You can actually, if you look up the her on Spotify, she's got kind of albums of work. She's a great talented musician.
Excellent.
As well as quite a prolific actor.
Excellent.
Has done an awful lot. One thing I want to, and sorry, and that's the end of the first episode,
and then we had it. Five songs and in 40 minutes.
It's a lot.
Yeah,
very quick. One of the things I just want to really speak to with positivity and enthusiasm is I really want to celebrate how good the acting, bar a couple of moments that we've mentioned, across the board is.
Yeah.
Such of a higher standard than even other Steve Bochco productions, but also like generally TV in general.
Yeah.
It's so much better than the type of Hollywood films that were being made because the acting has depth and understanding to it. It has pace. And I was like, why is that happening? Because the only difference is that you're hiring musical theatre actors. And I just want this to be said, because we've talked a lot on this podcast about our love for Aaron Sorkin, and as a great TV writer, film writer and showrunner. Aaron Sorkin always testifies a lot, you know, says a lot of his work being successful is creditable often to the fact that he hires musical theatre actors an awful lot. Whether that be people like Kristen Chenoweth or like Rob Lowe, who's done quite a bit of musical theatre, or Richard Schiff, who's directed a lot of theatre and works. So he loves stage actors and musical theatre actors specifically, even though there are no songs in a West Wing episode, although there should be.
Yeah,
I don't know why Aaron Sorkin hasn't written the musical book yet. He'd be perfect. But there is a real weight and skill and artistry that musical theatre actors do incredibly well with TV. And I think it's a mixture of lots of different skill sets that stage actors and musical theatre actors have to learn, like learning things incredibly quickly, doing things on the fly, being reliable, being safe, being sober, turning up on time, learning your lines. Like, maybe it's all of those things. But also, I think it's just a level of because you're not being hired because of your model level looks, you have to actually be able to act.
Yeah.
And you notice that with none of these actors are particularly, oh my goodness, knock my head off, gorgeous, beautiful. And as a result, I actually understand and invest in their characters, and they're really good actors.
Yeah,
lots of different options there for why that is, but I think it's really to be said that every time there's a musical theatre or a seasoned stage actor in a piece of TV, 99% of the time, it's still going to be better.
Yep.
Absolutely. So that was really lovely.
Yep. Couldn't agree more.
Good.
Well, there we go.
Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you, Adam. First one down. 10 more to go.
I can't believe we're doing this for the next 10 weeks of our life, though. Not 10 weeks of our life.
More than that.
10 months?
About a year.
Of our life. What? That's an incredible request.
We might have to start doing two.
Two episodes
per podcast.
But we've done the inaugural introduction.
Exactly.
You know the language of the piece now. I mean, we don't.
No, not at all.
It's one of the biggest songs of the show that we were convinced that would be in the pilot isn't in the pilot. We've got that coming up soon.
Yeah, I cannot wait.
That needs a whole episode, that song on its own.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And as always, in the meantime, you know how to get a hold of us. If you want to let us know when the last time was you placed your hand high up on a wall behind a urinal for support, or you have any other comments, questions or suggestions, you can get in touch with us via Twitter at Macabre Podcaster. You can drop us an email, podcastermacabre@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, fb.me/podcastermacabre. And also you can, of course, like, share, subscribe, and listen to this podcast, to our Jonathan Creek podcast, all our previous oeuvre on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Anchor, wherever you get your podcasts from.
In the meantime, I have been Callum Hughes.
I have been David Shopland.
We'll see you next week.
Be careful out there.
Days of sunshine, tears and rain, precious memories of years go by. Hours of darkness, fear and pain, all the time that we had. When all that's left is a photograph, not one gonna